Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, you are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. The following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining us for the December 1st, Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Omicron, state hunts for new strain, by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Sterling Ranch in Littleton, homes by the range, by Conrad Swanson, the Denver Post. Michigan authorities, student kills three, wounds eight at school, by Mike Householder and Ryan Kriska, the Associated Press. Omicron, state hunts for new strain. Officials monitoring wastewater say detection of variant just a matter of time, by Jessica Seaman, the Denver Post. Colorado public health officials are expanding their search for the new Omicron variant of the coronavirus, including by monitoring communities' wastewater, and said Tuesday that it's just a matter of time before the new strain is detected in the state. Omicron, which has not yet been confirmed in the U.S., was identified last week as having been discovered in South Africa. But officials said Tuesday it had been detected in the Netherlands at least a week before the World Health Organization labeled it a variant of concern. Emily Travanti, director of Colorado State Lab, said during a news briefing Tuesday that the state is reviewing a portion of all positive COVID-19 tests to look for the variant. We continue to ensure that we are getting test samples in from all across the state and make sure we are seeing a subsampling of everything that is happening in the environment, she said, adding, I'm confident that we are able to see Omicron when it does appear in Colorado. Public health officials are concerned that mutations found in the Omicron variant could make it more transmissible or that immune response may not be as effective, which could raise the possibility of reinfections, said Dr. Rachel Herlihy, the state epidemiologist, during the briefing. However, she stressed that there is much that remains unknown about the variant, including the severity of illness that it may cause. The reality is we do have a lot to learn still, Herlihy said. Colorado's health department is searching for the Omicron variant using diagnostic testing and clinical sequencing. About 16% of all positive PCR tests are genetically sequenced by the state in an effort to identify which variant of COVID-19 has infected the person, according to the agency. But public health officials believe the state's wastewater surveillance program, which began in August 2020, will discover the presence of the new variant more quickly than other methods. The health department updated the program this weekend so that it can now detect genetic markers of Omicron in wastewater. Almost 50% of people with COVID shed the virus in their stool, even if they don't have symptoms. So the state is partnering with 21 utilities to identify the virus and detect specific variants within broader communities via their wastewater, said Rachel Jervis, an epidemiologist with the health department. But wastewater monitoring cannot identify COVID-19 infections in individual people. That wastewater surveillance is how the agency first confirmed the Delta variant's presence in Colorado, she said. The first Delta infections were discovered in Mesa County in May. Before that, however, Colorado was the first state to identify a COVID-19 variant in the U.S. when it detected, which later became known as the Alpha variant, in Elbert County last December. That case was confirmed by the state lab and was notable because public health experts said the U.S. lacked the infrastructure needed to quickly find genetic variations of the coronavirus. The more contagious Delta variant is driving the state's most recent surge in COVID-19 cases, with it making up most cases since July, Chiranti said. The state is in the middle of one of the worst waves of the pandemic, and while public health officials said the decline in the new COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations in recent days is a sign that the situation is improving, they cautioned that the Thanksgiving holiday could be skewing the numbers as fewer people get tested and data can lag around the holidays. On Tuesday, 1,466 people were hospitalized statewide with COVID-19, a slight drop from the 1,473 patients a day earlier. It's certainly reassuring to see things seem to be trending in the right direction, Hurley said. But it's always important to keep in mind, too, that following holidays, we do sometimes see increases in cases that occur following holiday gatherings and changes in interactions and contacts that people have. Public health officials said they need to understand more about the Omicron variant before changing their approach to the pandemic, although they emphasized getting vaccinated and wearing masks indoors are still important. Coloradans who are vaccinated should get their booster shot so that they have a stronger immune protection when they are exposed to the virus, Hurley said. However, the agency is not considering a statewide mask mandate following the discovery of the variant, said Scott Bookman, Colorado's COVID-19 incident commander. Denver and most metro area counties have reinstated requirements that people wear masks in indoor public spaces. What we continue to see is a variable spread of disease across our state, he said. And we know at this point in the pandemic, a single set of orders across the state is unlikely to be an effective technique. Sterling Ranch in Littleton, homes by the range. Housing development holds cattle drive to keep in touch with Western roots and as part of pasture management plan. By Conrad Swanson, the Denver Post. Dozens of cattle, Angus mostly, hoofed their way through the Sterling Ranch housing development south of Littleton on a recent Sunday morning. Cowboys and at their flanks, either on horseback or four-wheelers. The cattle drive wasn't off course, Harold Smethels, founder and chair of the development company, said he wants the herd on the property as a way to keep his 3,400 acres as natural as possible. There used to be big herds of bison, which for thousands of years used to go through, aerate, eat, and control the grassland, Smethel said. The cows are doing exactly what the bisons used to do. The few dozen cattle will soon be joined by perhaps 100 or more of the whole herd. We'll spend the winter grazing just west of the development, Smethel said. By living on the land, the cattle will cut the risk of wildfires, boost soil health, and provide a more hospitable environment for some of the area's ground-based species, such as burrowing owls. Then in the spring, the cattle will be taken back to their normal pastures throughout the area, and the land will be allowed to freely grow again, Smethel said. That method is called rotational grazing, said Lauren Connell, director of stewardship for the Bird Conservancy of the Rockies. And in the past decade, it's grown more popular across the West. Farmers and ranchers typically use rotational grazing, but Smethel's property is the first time Connell said she's seen it used at a housing development. Because this is the first season of rotational grazing at Sterling Ranch, Connell said it's too early to tell how effective it will be, but she'll watch with great interest. Representatives from the Bird Conservancy, Denver Botanic Gardens, and other ecological and engineering experts work with Smethels to develop his overall prairie management plan for the property, which includes rotational grazing. It's a simple enough concept, Connell said. Essentially, three things naturally disturbed or destroyed the land in a good way before human development, ultimately sparking regeneration and new growth. Fire, prairie dogs, and grazing large wild herds, she explained. Humans tend to kill prairie dogs and work hard to either prevent wildfires entirely or put them out quickly once they've started, Connell continued. Additionally, humans hunted the once massive herds of bison to near extinction. By reintroducing periodic grazing with herds of cattle, humans can create a bit of the healthy destruction and create new life, Connell said. It's an old technique applied to a modern world. Brian Voigt, CEO of the Denver Botanic Gardens, said, the cattle provide healthy destruction by eating overgrown vegetation, much of which is dead or dying, thereby shrinking wildfire risk, Smethel said. So then the worst you get is a little grass fire, he said. You put that out, no big deal. While the cattle are grazing, their cloven hooves aerate the soil, Smethel said. Clearing out old vegetation and loosening the soil makes the land habitable for creatures such as prairie dogs, which can, in turn, make the ground more hospitable for burrowing owls native to the area, Connell said. And what comes in must go out. Cattle excrement fertilizes the soil without the chemicals found in modern fertilizers. The residents do have to put up with the smell, but it's better than a fire, Smethels added with a chuckle. In a place like Sterling Ranch, rotational grazing is a good way to restore the ground to a more natural state, bring back natural vegetation and animals that have been driven away by development, Voigt said. So many of the other ranches or farms operate where everything is plowed up every year and lots of chemicals are dumped down, Voigt said, adding that such land management practices aren't sustainable. Soils, when depleted, have destroyed countless civilizations over time, Voigt said. Just think about our Dust Bowl. Rotational grazing can not only bring those soils back to life, but even increase the crop yield, he said. To be effective and sustainable, however, the grazing must be well thought out and intentional, Connell cautioned. The number of cows, time spent grazing, and amount of forage available are all crucial factors to consider. Allowing cattle to graze indefinitely could leave land barren, or moving the animals too often could drain their energy, she said. The process also has to be economical for landowners, Voigt added. He noted that not everybody has ready access to dozens of cattle or the know-how to start a rotational grazing program. The Botanic Gardens Chatfield Farms is developing a best practices model which could be used as a reference for anyone interested in rotational grazing, he added. The approach could be used on large tracts of land and drawn down from much smaller properties, Voigt said. A single homeowner could even use one of the several goats to get similar results on their property. People really can take this to their own backyard, Voigt said. They probably can't have a cattle drive, but they can create a pollinator garden or plant gardens that use less water using native and native adaptive plants. They think about what they're putting into their own soils, how they compost. Smethel said he'll fine-tune the practice over time and is discussing a second cattle drive for next year. In the meantime, he's looking forward to April when the herd will move to pasture north of West Titan Road, where many cows will give birth, starting the cycle of life all over again. Michigan. Authorities. Student kills three, wounds eight at school. By Mike Householder and Ryan Kriska, the Associated Press. Oxford Township, Michigan. A 15-year-old sophomore opened fire at his Michigan high school on Tuesday, killing three students, including a 16-year-old boy who died in a deputy's patrol car on the way to the hospital, authorities said. Eight other people are wounded, some critically. Oakland County Sheriff Michael Bouchard said late Tuesday that investigators were still trying to determine a motive for the shooting at Oxford High School in Oxford Township, a community of about 22,000 people roughly 30 miles north of Detroit. The person that's got the most insight and the motive is not talking, Bouchard said in a news conference. The suspect's father had bought the 9mm Sig Sauer used in the shooting on Friday, Bouchard said, adding that he did not know why the man bought the gun. Bouchard said that the suspect had practiced shooting with the gun and posted pictures of the target and the weapon. The three students who were killed were 16-year-old Tate Meyer, 14-year-old Hannah St. Juliana, and 17-year-old Madison Baldwin. Bouchard said Meyer died in a patrol car as a deputy tried to get him to a hospital. Bouchard said a teacher who received a graze wound to the shoulder was discharged from the hospital, but seven students ranging in age from 14 to 17 remain hospitalized with gunshot wounds, including 14-year-old girl who was on a ventilator after surgery. Undersheriff Mike McCabe said earlier that authorities were aware of allegations circulating on social media that there had been threats of a shooting at the roughly 1,700 student school before Tuesday's attack, but he cautioned against believing that narrative until investigators can look into it. He also downplayed the significance of an incident in early November when a deer head was thrown off the school roof, which he said was absolutely unrelated to the shooting. The vandalism prompted school administrators to post two letters to parents on the school's website earlier in November, saying they were responding to rumors of a threat against the school but had found none. Authorities didn't immediately release the shooting suspect's name, but Bouchard said deputies arrested him within minutes of arriving at the school in response to a flood of 9/11 calls about the attack, which happened shortly before 1 p.m. He said the deputies arrested him after he emerged from a bathroom with a gun, which he said had seven rounds of ammunition still in it. "I believe they literally saved lives having taken down the suspect with a loaded firearm while still in the building," Bouchard said. McCabe said the suspect's parents visited their son where he's being held and advised him not to talk to investigators, as is his right. "Police must seek permission from a juvenile suspect's parents or guardian to speak with them," he added. Oakland County Prosecutor Karen McDonald issued a statement Tuesday evening saying her office expects to issue charges quickly and that an update would be given Wednesday. Bouchard said the suspect had no prior run-ins with his department and he wasn't aware of any disciplinary history at the school. "That's part of our investigation to determine what happened prior to this event, and if some signs were missing, how were they missed and why," he said. President Joe Biden, before delivering remarks at a community college in Rosemont, Minnesota, said, "As we learn the full details, my heart goes out to the families enduring the unimaginable grief of losing a loved one." The school was placed on lockdown after the attack, with some children sheltering in locked classrooms while officers searched the premises. They were later taken to a nearby Meyer grocery store to be picked up by their parents. The district said in a statement that all the schools would be closed for the rest of the week. Isabel Flores, a 15-year-old ninth grader, told WJBK-TV that she and other students heard gunshots and saw another student bleeding from the face. "Then they ran from the area through the rear of the school," she said. Authorities said they were searching the suspect's cell phone, school video footage, and social media posts for any evidence of a possible motive. School administrators had posted two letters to parents on the school's website in November, saying they were responding to rumors of a threat against the school following a bizarre vandalism incident. "That was a different incident, different student," McCabe said. Robin Redding said her son, Treshen Bryant, is a 12th grader at the school but stayed home Tuesday. Redding said her son had heard threats there could be a shooting. "This couldn't be just random," she said. Bryant said he texted several younger cousins in the morning and they said they didn't want to go to school and he got a bad feeling. He asked his mom if he could do his assignments online. Bryant said he had heard vague threats for a long time now about plans for a shooting. At a vigil at Lake Point Community Church on Tuesday night, Leanne Dursa choked back tears as she hugged friends and neighbors. Dursa has lived nearly all her 73 years in Oxford, and her grandchildren attended the high school. "Scared us all something terrible. It's awful," Dursa said of the shooting. You're on the hook, absolutely. Public defender. Wrong to not take case, judge says. Couple sued over federal office's refusal to represent them in criminal case by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. A federal magistrate judge on Monday urged the Colorado State Public Defender's Office to reconsider its decision to deny representation to a low-income couple in Larimer County, calling the office's refusal a wrong. Magistrate Judge Scott Varholik then went on to rule against the couple, finding he could not force the public defender's office to take up the couple's defense because federal courts are generally barred from meddling in state court cases. But Varholik nevertheless seriously urged the public defender's office to voluntarily reconsider its stance, calling the case concerning and saying he was troubled by it, according to a recording of the hearing obtained by the Denver Post. I do not think the public defender has the opportunity to potentially right what I think was a wrong here, he said. At a minimum, a wrong in ignoring their own procedures and ignoring the procedures set forth in the Chief Justice Directive, I do urge the public defender to reconsider that decision. Married couple Sari and Dale Brubaker filed the federal lawsuit in October. Both are facing criminal charges of felony child abuse, assault and tampering with evidence in Larimer County, and had hoped to be represented by a public defender. The Brubakers together make less than $3,000 a year. Because their income is so low, the couple should automatically qualify for a public defender under both the state's rules and the public defender's policies, records show. Five attorneys estimated the Brubakers' defenses would cost $100,000 each, court records showed. Their attorney in the civil case, Christopher Gregory, argued paying these costs would leave them destitute. The couple could afford an attorney for the lawsuit because it was significantly less expensive than mounting a criminal defense, he said. The public defender's office refused to take on the Brubakers' cases, finding that the couple had too much money to qualify for a publicly funded defense. A Larimer County judge found the couple was not indigent because they have savings of about $125,000, two vehicles, a home in Wyoming, and land in Colorado worth a combined $338,000. The public defender's office can seek an exception to the state's rules on financial eligibility, but they did not do so in this case, court records show. Rather, Larimer County District Court Judge Lori Dean considered the office's denial to be a de facto request for an exception, which she then granted. Varholik said Monday that the exception has questionable applicability, according to the recording. I spent years as a public defender and years as a state public defender in Pennsylvania, and I'm not aware of any case in which either of those offices that I belong to would apply for an exception and try to avoid representation of an individual, Varholik said. But he nevertheless denied the Brubaker's request on the grounds he was prohibited from interfering with the state case. The couple is scheduled to go on trial this month without attorneys. They face more than two decades in prison if convicted. These guys are going to trial. They don't have representation. They're going to get convicted, and the public defender on the back end will be required to provide their appellate counsel, Gregory said Monday. It really is silly the public defender won't consider the determination. Merck, U.S. panel narrowly backs COVID-19 pill, by Matthew Peroni, the Associated Press. Washington. A panel of U.S. health advisors on Tuesday narrowly backed a closely watched COVID-19 pill from Merck, setting the stage for a likely authorization of the first drug that Americans could take at home to treat the coronavirus. The Food and Drug Administration panel voted 13-10 that the antiviral drug's benefits outweigh its risks, including potential birth defects if used during pregnancy. I see this as an incredibly difficult decision with many more questions than answers, said panel chair Dr. Lindsay Baden of Harvard Medical School, who voted in favor of the drug. He said the FDA would have to carefully tailor the drug's use for patients who stand to benefit most. The recommendation came after hours of debate, about the drug's modest benefits and potential safety issues. Most experts backing the treatment stress that it should not be used by anyone who is pregnant and called on FDA to recommend extra precautions before the drug is prescribed, such as pregnancy tests for women of childbearing age. The vote specifically backed the drug for adults with mild to moderate COVID who face the greatest risks, including older people and those who with conditions like obesity and asthma. Most experts also said the drug shouldn't be used in vaccinated people who weren't part of Merck's research and haven't been shown to benefit. The FDA isn't bound by the panel's recommendation and is expected to make its own decision before year's end. The antiviral is already authorized in the UK. The drug, molnupiravir, could provide a much-needed weapon against the virus as colder weather pushes case counts higher and U.S. officials brace for the arrival of a new Omicron variant. Merck hasn't specifically tested its drug against the new variant, but said it could have some potency based on its effectiveness against other strains of the coronavirus. That uncertainty frustrated many panelists as they grappled with whether to back the treatment for millions of Americans. With no data saying it works with new variants, I really think we need to be careful about saying that this was the way to go, said Dr. David Hardy of Charles Drew University School of Medicine and Science, who ultimately voted to back the drug. On Friday, Merck released updated data that paint a less compelling picture of the drug's effectiveness than just a few weeks earlier. Merck said his final study results showed molnupiravir reduced hospitalization and death by 30% among adults infected with the coronavirus when compared with adults taking a placebo. That effect was significantly less than the 50% reduction it first announced based on incomplete results. For many panelists, the most effect wasn't enough to outweigh the drug's potential toxicity to human fetuses. Given the large potential population affected, the risk of widespread effects on potential birth defects has not been adequately studied, Dr. Sankar Swaminathan of the University of Utah School of Medicine, who voted against the drug. FDA scientists told the panelists earlier Tuesday that company studies in rats showed the drug caused birth defects when given at very high doses. FDA staffers concluded the data suggests that molnupiravir may cause fetal harm when administered to pregnant individuals. The agency is weighing a blanket restriction against any use in pregnant women or allowing doctors to use the drug in rare cases. Some panelists said the option should be left open for pregnant mothers who have high-risk COVID-19 and may have few other treatment options. Dr. Janet Cragen, who backed the drug, said that even with tight restrictions, some pregnant women would inevitably take the antiviral. I don't think you can ethically tell a woman with COVID-19 that she can't have the drug or if she decided that's what she needs, said Cragen, a panel member and staffer with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I think the final decision has to come down to the individual woman and her provider. Merck's drug inserts tiny errors into the coronavirus's genetic code to stop it from reproducing. That genetic effect has raised concerns that the drug could spur more virulent strains of the virus. Antiviral pills have long been seen as a key advance beyond the currently used antibody drugs, which must be injected or infused by health professionals. But given the shortcomings of Merck's data, several experts said they would prioritize patients to receive the older drugs. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Frank and Kelly, May 14, 1929 to November 22, 2021. A rosary will take place on December 6th at 7 p.m. at Horan and McConaty, 3020 Federal Boulevard, Denver, 80211. Funeral Mass December 7th at 11 a.m. St. Cajetan Cahillan Catholic Church, 299 South Raleigh Street, Denver, 80219. Burial to follow at Mount Olivet. Please visit HoranCares.com for full obituary. Eileen Convery, March 29, 1944 to November 24, 2021. Eileen peacefully passed away on November 24, 2021. A memorial service for Eileen will be held on December 7, 10 a.m. at Fairmount's Quebec Place Chapel. Please visit FairmountFuneralHome.com for Eileen's full obituary. Robert Bob Couts, October 2, 1941 to November 25, 2021. Robert Bob Thomas Couts, 80, of Denver, Colorado, transitioned peacefully at home. He was born in Lazier, Colorado, the son of Thomas and Mary Leonard Couts. Employed at General Iron Works, Stern Rogers, he retired from Electron Corporation. Bob is survived by his sister Martha Todd of Montrose, Colorado, and by his two daughters and their spouses, Dana and Ann Schmikas, Christine Angelicki, and Robert, and grandchildren Ty Angelicki and Molly Angelicki, all of Denver. He was preceded in death by his brother James and parents. To read the full obituary, go to obituaries.easycremation.com /obituary/Robert-Couts. In keeping with Bob's wishes, no memorial service will be scheduled. Contributions in Bob's name to the Dumb Friends League, www.ddfl.org. Margaret Peggy Grace Danborn, May 3rd, 1939 to November 22nd, 2021. Wife of Don, mother to Marie Kellen, Paul, wife Laura, Joseph, wife Deblina Chakraborty, Sarah Grace, husband Joel Dunow, grandma to Caitlin, Dominic, Rhiannon, Farah, Lucinda Danborn, and August and Inga Dunow. Memorial service Monday, December 6, 6:30 p.m. at Horan, 7577 West 80th Avenue. Funeral Tuesday, December 7th, 10 a.m. at Shrine of St. Anne, Arvada. Private interment at Air Force Academy. In lieu of flowers, suggest donation to Arvada Community Table, COTABLE.org. Complete obituary at HoranCares.com. Walter E. Houghton, Jr., March 15, 1924 to October 21, 2021. Walter E. Houghton, Jr., age 97, of Denver, passed away peacefully in Littleton, Colorado on October 21, 2021, following a short illness. His cheerful attitude, kindness, generosity, and wonderful smile will be missed by many. Walter is preceded in death by his wife of 56 years, Rosalie Moore Houghton, 2004, survived by his son Gary E. Houghton, wife Ann Carney, and daughter Peggy H. Faison, husband John, granddaughters Lindsay Houghton and Bridget Houghton, and grandsons Christopher Faison and Nicholas Faison. For full obituary and a video slide tribute of his life, visit HoranCares.com. Audrey Lucy Jonas. A massive Christian burial will be held Thursday, December 2nd, 2021, 11 a.m. at St. Mary Catholic Church. Please see full obituary at DrinkWineMortuary.com. Verlene Jean Spatz, August 23rd, 2021. Verlene Gene Spatz, 88, of Highlands Ranch, Colorado, died August 23rd, 2021. A memorial celebration will be held at 11:30 a.m. on Saturday, December 4th at Heffelbauer Funeral Services, 8955 South Ridgeline Boulevard, Suite 100, Highlands Ranch, 80129. Gene is survived by his wife, Patricia Ann Spatz, sister Carolyn Davidson, daughter-in-law Carol Spatz, and grandchildren Philip and Elizabeth Spatz, and many nieces and nephews in the Kansas City area. He is preceded in death by his beloved only son, Kevin Allen Spatz. For full obituary, head to Heffelbauer, to the Heffelbauer website. Sherilyn Sherry Cerise Scott Stock, 84, of Denver, Colorado, passed away November 25th, 2021. The Rosary will be Friday, December 3rd, 2021 at 12 p.m., St. Jude Catholic Church, 9405 West Florida Avenue, Lakewood, followed by immediately by funeral mass. Full obituary at HoranCares.com.
That's the same.
Doris R. Sumnicht, February 28, 1933 to November 25, 2021. Age 88, passed away November 25, 2021. Presided in death by spouse Warren. She was born in Missouri and taught school in Washington and Wyoming. Retired after many years of service with Colorado Civil Rights Division. No services pending. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Appeals Court weighs Trump arguments to withhold records. By Norman Merchant, the Associated Press. Washington. A panel of judges on Tuesday questioned whether they had the authority to grant former President Donald Trump's demands and stop the White House from allowing the release of documents related to the January 6th insurrection by Trump supporters. But the judges also noted that there may be times when a former president will be justified in trying to stop the incumbent from disclosing records. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit heard arguments from lawyers for Trump and the House committee seeking the records as part of its investigation into the Capitol riot. Trump's attorneys want the court to reverse a federal judge's ruling that the National Archives and Records Administration to turn over the records after President Joe Biden waived executive privilege. Trump supporters broke into the Capitol on January 6th after a rally near the White House where he made false claims of election fraud and challenged them to fight like hell. About 700 people have been federally charged. 9 people died during and after the rioting. The National Archives has said that the records Trump wants to block include presidential diaries, visitor logs, speech drafts, handwritten notes concerning the events of January 6th from the files of former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and a draft executive order on the topic of election integrity. Compared to U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, whose ruling Trump is contesting, the three judges on the appeals court spent relatively little time weighing the importance of the documents themselves. They instead focused most of the hearing Tuesday on what role federal courts should have when an incumbent president and a former president are at odds over records from the former's administration. The judges sharply questioned both sides and challenged them with hypothetical scenarios. To Trump's lawyers, Judge Patricia Millett suggested a situation where a current president negotiating with a foreign leader needed to know what promises a former president had made to that leader. The incumbent might seek to release a transcript of a phone call or other documents from the previous administration for national security reasons, the judge said. To be clear, your position as a former president could come in and file a lawsuit, Millett said. Trump lawyer Justin Clark responded, "That is our position." To a lawyer for the House committee, Millett raised a scenario where a newly elected president, may seek retribution against a disliked predecessor. The new president and Congress, led by the same party, might declare that there was a national security interest in releasing all of the former president's records, even at risk of endangering people's lives, she said. Needless to say, the former president comes to court, says, "Hang on," Millett said. "What happens?" She did not say she was referring to any president and rejected committee lawyer Daniel Letter's response referencing a president who fomented an insurrection. "We're not going to make it that easy," she said. Letter argued that the determination of a current president should outweigh predecessors in almost all circumstances and noted that both Biden and Congress were in agreement that the January 6th records should be turned over. "It would be astonishing for this court to override the current president and Congress," Letter said. Democratic presidents nominated all three judges who heard arguments Tuesday. Ex-Trump aide Meadows cooperating with House January 6th insurrection panel. By Mary Claire Jelonek and Eric Tucker, the Associated Press. Washington. Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's former chief of staff, is cooperating with House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection, putting off for now the panel's threat to hold him in contempt, the committee's chairman said Tuesday. The panel will continue to assess his degree of compliance. Mississippi Rep. Benny Thompson said in a statement, he said Meadows has produced records and will soon appear for an initial deposition. The agreement comes after 2 months of negotiations between Meadows and the committee and after the Justice Department indicted longtime Trump ally Steve Bannon for defying a subpoena. Meadows' lawyer had previously indicated that his client would not comply, a stance the committee said was unacceptable. The select committee expects all witnesses, including Mr. Meadows, to provide all information requested and that the select committee is lawfully entitled to receive, Thompson said. Under the tentative agreement, Meadows could potentially decline to answer the panel's question about his most sensitive conversations with Trump and what Trump was doing on January 6th, as hundreds of rioters violently broke into the Capitol and interrupted the certification of Joe Biden's 2020 election victory. Trump, who told supporters to fight like hell that morning, has attempted to hinder much of the committee's work, including in an ongoing court case by arguing that Congress cannot obtain information about his private White House conversations. Meadows' lawyer, George Terwillinger, said in a statement that we appreciate the select committee's openness to receiving voluntary responses on non-privileged topics. Terwillinger said he was continuing to work with the committee and its staff on a potential accommodation that would not require Meadows to waive the executive privileges claimed by Trump or forfeit the longstanding position that senior White House aides cannot be compelled to testify before Congress. The deal with Meadows highlights how the committee is trying to balance its need for information about Trump's role in the January 6th insurrection against the desire to complete the investigation quickly. While the committee has rejected Trump's legal arguments and Biden has waived executive privilege to hand over documents and records, the panel wants to avoid lengthy legal entanglements that could delay their work. Still, Meadows' intention to work with the panel is a victory for the 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans on the committee, especially as they seek interviews with lower-profile witnesses who may have important information to share. The panel has so far subpoenaed more than 40 witnesses and interviewed more than 150 people behind closed doors. Terwillinger had previously said that Meadows wouldn't comply with the panel's September subpoena because of Trump's privileged claims. But the House panel insists it has questions for Meadows that do not directly involve conversations with Trump. "You were the president's chief of staff and have critical information regarding many elements of our inquiry," Thompson wrote in September's subpoena. "It appears you were with or in the vicinity of President Trump on January 6th, had communication with the president and others on January 6th regarding events at the Capitol, and are a witness regarding the activities of the day." First black woman to be inducted. Josephine Baker honored at France's Pantheon by Sylvie Corbett and Jeffrey Schaefer, the Associated Press. Paris. Josephine Baker, the U.S.-born entertainer and anti-Nazi spy and civil rights activist, was inducted into France's Pantheon on Tuesday, becoming the first black woman to receive the nation's highest honor. Baker's voice resonated through the streets of Paris's famed Left Bank as recordings from her extraordinary career kicked off an elaborate ceremony at the Dome Pantheon Monument. Baker joined other French luminaries honored at the site, including philosopher Voltaire, scientist Marie Curie, and writer Victor Hugo. Military officers from the Air Force carried her cenotaph along a red carpet that stretched for four blocks of cobblestone streets from the Luxembourg gates to the Pantheon. Baker's military medals lay atop the cenotaph, which was draped in the French tricolor flag and contained soil from her birthplace in Missouri, from France, and from her final resting place in Monaco. Her body stayed in Monaco at the request of her family. French President Emmanuel Macron paid tribute to a war hero, fighter, dancer, singer, a black woman defending black people, but first of all, a woman defending humankind. American and French, Josephine Baker fought so many battles with lightness, freedom, joy. Josephine Baker, you are entering into the Pantheon because, despite born American, there is a greater French woman than you. There is no greater French woman than you, he said. Baker was also the first American-born citizen and first performer to be immortalized into the Pantheon. She is not only praised for her world-renowned artistic career, but also for her active role in the French resistance during World War II, her actions as a civil rights activist, and her humanist values, which were displayed through the adoption of her 12 children from all over the world. 9 of them attended Tuesday's ceremony among 2,000 guests. Mum would have been very happy, Eko Bouillon, Baker's son, said after the ceremony. Mum would not have accepted to enter into the Pantheon if that was not as the symbol of all the forgotten people of history, the minorities. Bouillon added that what moved him the most were the people who gathered along the street in front of the Pantheon to watch. They were her public. People really loved her, he said. The tribute ceremony started with Baker's song, Me Revolia Paris. Paris, I'm back. The French army choir sang the French resistance song, prompting strong applause from the public. Her signature song, Two Loves, was then played by an orchestra accompanying Baker's voice on the Pantheon Plaza. During a light show displayed on the monument, Baker could be heard saying, I think I'm a person who has been adopted by France. It especially developed my humanist values, and that's the most important thing in my life. The homage included Martin Luther King's famed I Have a Dream speech. Baker was the only woman to speak before him at the 1963 March on Washington. Born in St. Louis, Baker became a megastar in the 1930s, especially in France, where she moved in 1925 as she sought to flee racism and segregation in the United States. The simple fact to have a black woman entering the Pantheon is historic. Black French scholar Pape Nidier, an expert on U.S. minority rights movements, told the Associated Press. When she arrived, she was first surprised, like so many African Americans who settled in Paris at the same time, at the absence of institutional racism. There was no segregation, no lynching. There was the possibility to sit at a cafe and be served by a white waiter, the possibility to talk to white people, to have a romance with white people, Nidier said. Baker was among several prominent black Americans, especially artists and writers, who found refuge in France after the two world wars, including famed writer and intellectual James Baldwin. Baker quickly became famous for her banana skirt dance routines and wowed audiences at Paris theater halls. Her shows were controversial, Nadia stressed, because many activists believed she was the propaganda for colonization, singing the song that French wanted her to sing. In 1938, Baker joined what is today called LICRA, a prominent anti-racist league. The next year, she started to work for France's counterintelligence services against Nazis, notably collecting information from German officials who said who she met at parties. She joined the French resistance using her performances as cover for spying activities during World War II. Celebrity surgeon Dr. Oz running for Senate in Pennsylvania. Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Dr. Mehmet Oz, the celebrity heart surgeon best known as the host of TV's The Dr. Oz Show, after rocketing to fame on Oprah Winfrey's show, announced Tuesday that he is running for Pennsylvania's open U.S. seat, Senate seat, as a Republican. Oz, 61, will bring his name, recognition, and wealth to a wide-open race that is expected to be among the most nation's most competitive and could determine the control of the Senate in next year's election. Oz, a longtime New Jersey resident, enters a Republican field that is resettling with an influx of candidates and a new opportunity to appeal to voters loyal to former President Donald Trump after the candidate endorsed by Trump exited the race. In a video message on social media, Oz cast himself as a sort of champion for people's health, who took on the medical establishment to argue against costly drugs and skyrocketing medical bills, and is prepared to fight a government that he said has mishandled the COVID-19 pandemic. Also, Oz also makes a pitch to Trump loyalists, and possibly Trump, too, by invoking Trump's slogan for his governing philosophy, America First. As a heart surgeon, I know how precious life is, Oz says. Pennsylvania needs a conservative who will put America first, who can reignite our divine spark, bravely fight for freedom, and tell it like it is. New York City okays safe sites for drug use, aims to curb overdoses. New York, the first officially authorized safe havens for people to use heroin and other narcotics, have been cleared to open in New York City in hopes of curbing deadly overdoses, officials said Tuesday. The privately run overdose prevention centers provide a monitoring place for drug users to partake. Also known as supervised injection sites or safer consumption spaces, they exist in Canada, Australia, and Europe, and have been discussed for years in New York and some other U.S. cities and states. A few unofficial facilities have operated for some time. Proponents use the facilities as pragmatic, life-saving tools for stopping overdoses, which are claiming a record number of lives in the U.S. and its most populous city. Opponents, however, see the sites as moral failures and essentially sanctioning people harming themselves and create hubs of drug use. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. We invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
The Audio Information Network of Colorado.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, December the 1st, 2021. I'm Mike Clifford. The U.S. Supreme Court today takes up arguments in a high-stakes abortion case. Our Mike Mullen reports it coincides with divisive arguments over voter fraud, mask mandates, and school curriculum.
This fall, the Annenberg Public Policy Center released its annual survey of overall public smarts about the branches of government. Adults who correctly named all three branches increased to 56%, But the center's Kathleen Hall Jamieson calls this woefully inadequate.
If one doesn't understand that there are three branches, that lack of knowledge increases the likelihood that when asked whether someone thinks that if the Supreme Court issues unpopular rulings, it might be best to get rid of the Supreme Court, a person is more likely to say yes.
Some of the divisive issues in the scope of government and constitutional protections have surfaced in North Dakota. This includes the state taking part in a lawsuit to overturn a workplace vaccine requirement for COVID-19. Mask mandate debates also surfaced at many school board meetings across the state this fall.
The survey revealed 61% of Americans incorrectly believe that under the First Amendment, Facebook is required to allow all people to express themselves freely on the platform. The Oakland County Sheriff said three students were killed and eight others have been hurt when someone started shooting inside Oxford High School on Tuesday. That comes from Fox 2 TV Detroit. According to the undersheriff there, Michael McCabe, three students were killed in the shooting and there were at least eight other victims, including a teacher. The sheriff also said the suspect is a 15-year-old sophomore at the school and has invoked his right to remain silent. The $1.7 trillion Build Back Better Act will soon get a vote in the Senate. And in New York, advocates say it could mean major improvements to health coverage for lower-income adults and children.
The Georgetown University Center for Children and Families says states would be required to provide 12 months of continuous eligibility for children enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. Laura Castle of Medicaid Matters New York says Build Back Better also would increase postpartum coverage for new mothers from 60 days to 12 months.
We don't want someone to suddenly, 60 days after they've given birth, be without coverage. We know that transitioning from program to program is not always successful. It's not always affordable for someone. And so to have the economic security of Medicaid coverage is really critical.
Supporters of the bill say they want it passed by Christmas, but with increasing inflation, detractors are concerned about the cost and could push for trimming its scope. I'm Emily Scott.
This is PNS. Rural educators say the funding for broadband in the bipartisan infrastructure package signed into law last month is critical for their communities.
While many say this is a problem that has existed for decades, the increased need for high-speed internet for virtual work and learning during the pandemic put an added spotlight on the issue. Superintendent and principal of Whitefish Township Community Schools in the Upper Peninsula, Tom McKee, says their school had to supply Wi-Fi for many of their teachers and students. But he adds some families in his district live far enough off the main road that sometimes even with hotspots and satellite internet, it wasn't reliable.
So until we start thinking of broadband access as not just another utility, but as something that should be as common as, you know, your garbage getting picked up, I think we're going to continue to see this in rural areas.
The infrastructure bill included $65 billion for improving broadband nationwide, much specifically targeted at rural and tribal areas. I'm Lily Bolke reporting.
The U.S. ranks 27th for access to high-speed internet. That's according to AllConnect.com. And ranks about 14th in the world for speed of its mobile and broadband connections. And the Department of Natural Resources wants folks in Wisconsin to weigh in on its efforts to address chronic wasting disease, also known as CWD. For that report, we introduce our newest colleague, Jonah Chester.
The always fatal disease that affects the brains of some deer, elk, and moose appeared in Wisconsin for the first time nearly 20 years ago. Tom Haugie of the environmental advocacy group Wisconsin's Green Fire says since then, cases of CWD have increased from about 200 in 2002 to an all-time high of nearly 1,600 last year.
What we have seen is a steady increase in the distribution of the disease in the state, as well as the number of deer who are positive.
So far this year, the DNR has diagnosed nearly 500 cases of chronic wasting disease in wild deer. Finally, Eric Tegetoff tells us a new project with a grant from the federal government aims to invite Hispanic students in Oregon into agriculture and technology careers.
Chemeketa Community College in the Willamette Valley has received a grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The project will provide tuition waivers and paid internships for high school students and place 12 agriculture science students from the college as mentors in local high schools. Tim Ray is Dean of Agriculture Science and Technology at Chemeketa. He wants to fight the misconception that farm-related work is only done in the fields.
It's really training folks around how to manage agricultural enterprises and work with all of the technology that is included in producing the food, fiber, and fuel that runs the world.
This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported. We're heard on great radio stations. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Audio Information Network of Colorado wants to be sure you are conveniently and consistently receiving our broadcast. If you are having any technical issues with your AINC equipment or want to learn about the other options you may have to receive our broadcast, please call us at 303-786-7777, extension 108.